Very good.
Has the Great Chicken Out go good?
Yep.
Yes.
I have time riding when the Great Chicken Out happens. The road didn't change. So, I mean, that's important thing to do, and preparing us to stay to be ready for those kind of things. So we have Commissioner Strange joining us.
Hello.
Oh, I'm there. SHS Secretary Strange. I'm Cheryl.
Hello.
So welcome to the Safety Commission. I think you'll enjoy it. It's a great opportunity for us to work across state government and with our partners, and I really get a lot of Safety Commission, so hopefully you'll enjoy it too.
Thank you.
So with that, we are going to go with the approval of the 7:17 minutes. Oh, what
are you doing?
Oh, is that, you want to do that?
Sure.
Okay. I am Pat Kohler, and I'm the Director for the Department of Licensing.
I'm Andrea Sokola, and I'm from the City Council, and I represent the city.
I'm George Steele. I am a Unit 4 Judge in the City of Charleston, and I'm here with the DMV.
Yes, sir. This is Boston State Patrol for my business. I'm Glenn Gordon, representing Superintendent Mike Dalton from the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction.
I'm Jerry Nelson, the Public Safety Commission.
Jerry Brandel, the Public Safety Commission.
Mr. Weir, the City Secretary.
I'm going to start by giving a presentation to the Department of Health.
Cheryl Strange, Secretary for the Department of Social Health Services.
Yeah, Sarah Beck.
Kelly Baldwin, Washington Traffic Safety Commission.
Diana Conkle, DFA staff, Commissioner of Health and Public.
Bob Thompson, Traffic Safety Commission.
Mark Deal, Traffic Safety Commission.
Amy Thornton, Traffic Safety Commission.
Ross Norman, Wood County Sheriff, Deputy Office.
Wes Reckler, Wood County Sheriff's Office.
Scott Wallace, Traffic Safety Commission.
Max Sutter, National Highway Council.
Which office is what those traffic commission?
Doug Nelson, Scott Wallace, Safety Commission.
Pam Hankett, Deputy Director, Washington Traffic Safety Commission.
Lynn Wilson, Jones Traffic Safety Commission.
So with that, we'll next on the agenda is the approval of the 7:17 minutes. Hopefully everybody's got a chance to review the minutes.
Yeah. Commissioner, we don't have a quorum today.
Oh.
So
okay. 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 All right, then we will make a motion to approve. Okay, so I'll just go back. Next up is the legislative update, and Shelley's going to give us an update on what's going on legislatively. Joe, did you want to preference this with anything?
In our July 2017 commission meeting, in April we made some changes on how we were going to do minutes, and then we actually have created a new form specifically addressing action items that we were going to hold for the next meeting. And so part of it was we were talking about legislative priorities and things that were coming up so that the commissioners knew kind of some of those issues that may be on the agenda, things that we need to keep our eyes on, and making sure that you have the information in case you're asked questions, either at the policy level or even just information level. So two of the items that we discussed last time was legislation that was proposed by Representative Lovick from the Homebridge County area, who had proposed reducing the VAC from 0.08 to 0.05. That went through the Public Safety Committee, and that went down to the House Transportation Committee, where it had died. But we're starting to see across the country a little bit of movement in this arena, is saying, is there a different way that we can now start impacting impaired driving? As we've seen in our own fatality rates across Washington, about 50% of our traffic fatalities have to do with impairment. Not just alcohol alone, we'll talk about that later on. But are there ways that we can help to reduce the number of fatalities around the impairment area? Utah passed the 0.05. You know, probably seen some of that stuff in the news. That is scheduled for the rollout of January of 2019 to help build the infrastructure, make changes, all of that, so that they're ready by 2019. We saw legislation here in Washington, Nevada, Hawaii, and there is one other state that I cannot remember, but there was some movement along this line. We've seen across the country, across international countries, where BAC levels are much lower. So Shelley's going to kind of give an overview of some of the issues around that. You have received in your email packets just some information to help prep you for this meeting. Hopefully you've got some questions. We're not driving policy. We just want to make sure that you're aware of, and then Shelley will talk about that. And then also talking about some kind of passenger safety issues that are coming up. So with that.
Aaron, can I share one other point?
Yes.
When we were at the American Motor Vehicle Administrators meeting, Colorado already has a 0.05. I didn't know that until they were sharing it, the enforcement side was sharing that.
I didn't know that. My memory is 25 in my history. Any good, and we're in Colorado, and had a respect to you, why?
So what, was 0.05 and then 0.08 based on the numbers, or?
That was their science list for one year. I don't remember the precise numbers of the computer law.
Okay.
We could like compare it, probably 0.05 and 0.10. I've been in this state.
So we might want to check that out because
yeah.
They did the enforcement folks, you know how you have that joint DMV enforcement meeting.
Yes.
Colorado and Utah were talking about this 0.05, but it didn't sound like Utah was one of the first states, but Colorado had already had it in place, which I didn't know.
So,
go ahead.
Erica's going to correct me if I'm wrong. I think that what Utah did was they changed their per se BAC level, meaning that if you have a BAC level at 0.05 or above in Utah, it's a criminal offense. And in Washington, our 0.08 is our per se. I think Colorado and British Columbia have a ticket offense between 0.05 and 0.79.
Yeah.
So it's not the per se level, and you don't, it's not a criminal prosecution, it's like getting a speeding ticket.
It's under permissible inference.
And they have a permissible inference for THC as well.
Yeah.
Which is different than our per se THC level.
Which those in Colorado would say, if you can explain that, they would like to know, because they really don't know what that means. So, and it's really been problematic for them. So, anyways.
So, last time we met, we kind of went over this, and what I said to you at that point was, as your legislative liaison for Traffic Safety Commission, these bills come up, I'm often asked to testify on them. Last year, we were told by the governor's office that anything with a budget, we weren't going to testify in favor of. So that's off the table. I did get permission to testify in favor of the distracted driving change, which was a big deal to get. But part of before I asked even governor's permission to testify in favor or against or whatever, I feel like we need to be all on the same page, because I would hate for the Traffic Safety Commission to support something that affected one of your agencies in a way that was negative. And I want to be able to go to the governor's office and say, yeah, the commissioners think this is something worth pursuing before I would even ask for governor's permission to testify on something in a particular manner. So that's how we're approaching it, and that's why we're having the discussion. We kind of had the discussion last time, and you had a lot more questions than we were really given time for, had the ability to answer. So I just wanted to try to answer some of those questions about where we are, what the data looks like, what happened when we went to 0.08. The paper, I believe, is in your packet. It starts with the discussion changing Washington's per se alcohol limit. And I don't know if you guys had a chance to read that before you came or not. I'm not counting on it.
I was.
All right, Michael. So
this is where we are right now. We experienced a lot of nice decreases in traffic fatals overall up until 2013. 2014, we saw a little bump. 2015, we saw a big bump. And 2016 preliminary numbers, 235, so not the decrease that would bring us back to pre-2013 levels by any means. And the role of impairment on that. The role of impairment on that is about half of the total fatals. So 278 involve a driver that had a BAC of 0.08 or more, or had a positive drug test come back. But the really interesting thing that we've been seeing is the blue line here is alcohol only. So when we look at, or, when you look at this blue line, that is drivers that had a positive BAC. And what we saw with positive BACs is that it's been dropping dramatically over time. And this is 2015, it went down. When 2015, everything else went up by quite a bit. The green line, however, is positive for drugs. And so when we look at this increase overall, we can really see that it's being driven by drugs and not necessarily alcohol. So this line is the one that keeps me up at night. This line is when a driver only has one drug in their system, and that's been really consistent over the last years. The red line is when they've only had alcohol in their system. And the green line is when they've tested positive for alcohol and drugs or multiple drugs. And I don't even know what that is. You know what I mean? We haven't done the research yet to tell us why people are showing up in fatals with multiple drugs in their system.
Is that national trends?
That's a really good question. Nationally, what do we know about drugs nationally, Stacey?
Oh, okay.
From a national health practice, you don't have a lot of data.
Right now, it's only doing the same thing from a second grade teacher, even the very teaching students. That has included one of the past campaigns, and that's what's trying to get in terms of humanization of teaching, for instance, the concept of talk about drug driving, access back to the teaching for alcohol. But yes, with the information that I've seen, this is not true.
Washington is an amazing data collector compared to other states. We have one toxicology lab where all of our testing goes to, so we can get results from that fairly easily. Many states have many different labs that might be even using different equipment. Our lab can validate something like THC down to 0.1 nanogram.
I was thinking about the results for you at the end of the month on opioid drugs. Is it then broken down to the opioid, or say, opioid drug use of the
drugs? So when we look at drugs, opioids, Stacey's going to correct me if I'm wrong, show up as a class of drugs that includes things like morphine, which could be administered at the, I got the yes from DOH, could be administered at the scene of the crash. So you were talking about a fatal crash, people are in stress, the ambulances come, there may be administered at the scene. We can't distinguish between morphine that was given at the scene of the crash and something like heroin that may have been on board before the crash, or any of those others in between. So you have, I always forget the name of it, Stacey. The
one thing that goes on the headline of most of them are quite very often heroin on the street, or even that, we don't know if it's actually one thing or we have a lot of other opioid use. But so far, in our state, stimulant and substance are still rising above the maybe you can write for example of the one that opioid is a good assignment, and the first hand of the type is.
It is. Billy's not a yes.
It is. Yeah,
It is, and it, yeah, you can refer to it as opiates.
Opiates.
That's easier to say.
Opiates.
Yeah, it's right. I mean, that's a really good point about it being administered on the scene for pain reduction. It would probably be less morphine and more other kinds, but.
Most of those drug categories, you know, if you look at them, they fall into the narcotic analgesics category. Like if the DRE was going to do an assessment, that's the category that they would call for heroin, morphine, hydrocodone.
Complex issue in the state. We're lucky to have the data that we have. But today we're going to talk about changing BAC levels. So we had a BAC level of 0.15 decades ago, and then we lowered it to 0.1, and then most recently we lowered it to 0.08. And that's per se, so supposedly if you test positive and that's what's in and everything else is in order, you can be found guilty on that alone. So 0.08, you're guilty. When that happened, we saw changes both in the number of drivers that had no DAC on board, no alcohol in their system at all. The percentage of that went up from, in 1994 to 1998, the average was 50% of drivers didn't have any alcohol in their system, to most recently, 2009 to 2013, 60% of drivers who were tested didn't have any alcohol in their system. So that was a good thing. And then in between the BAC levels, we didn't see a lot of changes. But when we looked at the higher BAC level, 0.15 and above, we actually saw that decrease from 30% to 24%. So that's part of what the people who are in favor of a 0.05 point to, is that it's not about that 0.05 necessarily. It's really about lowering those higher BAC levels and getting more people to just not drink.
I just had a couple.
In your packet, we kind of there were a lot of questions last time about what BAC means. So when I say most people are impaired at a 0.05, this is what we can say are the typical effects of someone at a 0.05. Exaggerated behavior, loss of small muscle control, impaired judgment, usually hearing really good, lowered alertness, release of inhibitions. And what that means for driving is reduced coordination, reduced ability to track moving objects, difficulty steering, and reduced response to emergency driving situations. So when I say most people are impaired at a 0.05, that's the kind of behavior that we're looking at. When I've gone to wet labs, which is where you post people with alcohol to train DREs on how to on how to process someone through the standard field sobriety test. I've gotten to go and be the person who cares for somebody who's being dosed with alcohol, and they hit this 0.05 level, and they all say, "I would never drive like this. This is ridiculous. I've never been this drunk in my life." 0.08, we can see. This is usually what we're thinking about with somebody who's stumbling, falling down drunk, which is well past too impaired to be driving an automobile. in my opinion. We also looked at, in your paper we talked a little bit about what a drink is. So standard drink size is 24 ounces of regular beer, which is a can of beer. If you go out to a restaurant and you're drinking pints of beer at higher VAC alcohol concentrates, they end up being about two beers worth of, you know, at one beer serving. So a lot of people, when we talk about, you know, I've only had a couple, you really have to pay attention to what a couple might be. So that doesn't count as one beer. And that's part of the problem we have, I think, communicating with the public about drinking and driving, is this idea that I've only had two. Well, really, you probably only had four if you were drinking at a restaurant with higher levels of alcohol concentration. And we asked questions about what it means in terms of drinks and alcohol content. So it varies by male and female. For men, a single drink might get you to a 0.04 if you're 100 pounds. If you're 200 pounds, a single drink might get you to a 0.02. For women, if they're small, a 100-pound woman, a single drink might get her to a 0.05. But a 200-pound woman, it'll be like a man at 0.02. So those were some, kind of some of the questions you guys had for me as we were talking about what it would mean to lower it to 0.05. The legislation to do it is really simple. It just crosses out every place in the law where it says 0.08 and changes it to 0.05. I don't remember if we had a fiscal note attached to it. I don't remember.
There was, and that's why when it passed out of the Law and Justice Committee or the Public Safety Committee, and then the House Transportation Committee, and had a hearing there because of a fiscal. I can't recall all of the elements in that, but there was some things. I think it was brought up that what we need to change as far as training, information, education, outreach, some of those things specifically. You know, around standard sobriety tests, we need to review some of that as far as DO5. There's just lots of different questions that came up. What would we need to change with the infrastructure to get
there's a lot of highway signs
that they
can
relate to, and that would be... Yes. Yeah. For the signage, you know, the education, some of the issues with the hospitality industry and working with that, so...
So in your paper, I kind of outline the arguments against going to 0.05 that we hear and will hear from the American Beverage Institute. Kind of, they're pretty predictable. 0.08 laws fail to save lives, but the chart that they even use to show that it fails to save lives shows a big reduction in the number of fatals. So I find that a really funny statement. They're going to say that one of the traffic deaths occur between 0.08 and 0.05, and that's definitely true. That is a smaller portion of the number of fatals that we see with alcohol. It is the higher VAC levels that we see more frequently in fatal crashes. But as we looked at our own data, the difference between 0.1 and 0.08 increased the number of drivers that were tested but didn't have any alcohol in their system, and the number of drivers that had those higher VAC levels in their system. So it's not necessarily going after that little piece. We're going to say that it could take as little as one drink to reach a 0.05 VAC level, and we definitely see that for smaller women, that's definitely true. But then if we look at what VAC levels mean, and we know that a 0.05 has significant impairment going on already, my point would be if a single drink is getting somebody impaired, it's not a good idea to have them not drink it before they drive. It says that 0.05 VAC levels don't reduce drunk driving deaths. But the study that they point to is Australia, when they moved from a 0.08 to a 0.05. And in Australia, we saw a decrease of an 18% of fatal crashes and a 14% reduction in serious injury crashes. So I would take that. If that's insignificant, I don't see that as being too insignificant. You'd be happy to have an 18% reduction, especially with the increases we've been seeing. So, I'm not here to recommend that you do one thing or another. I'm really here to just hear from you guys about your thoughts. It's a, you know, it's a big deal.
Shelley, when I shared this with our staff, the main feedback that we got is that you might want to also consider data around vehicle miles traveled along with the PAC, because of the changes that are going on with vehicle miles traveled, that might help give some additional data to consider when we move to the time.
I'm looking at Stacy, I'm going to make a motion to amend it. We'd be happy to share that with you guys.
Not a question, but just some ideas. I know that some countries, I think like Colorado, they may have a computer system. So the idea is to actually provide kind of a general deterrence, is looking at, you know, whether there are other alternatives as far as I'm going to plan my trip. If the AC level goes down to 0.05, what does that mean, and how do I actually change my own driving behavior to address that? So the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, is the one that came out with the recommendation as far back as 2014, and then in their 17-18 most wanted list. This is one of those things that they reiterate again and again, is that this would impact about 1,000 miles across the country. But ultimately, I mean, a lot of those are, you know, I think they probably have some algorithm to plug that into, but ultimately, if that was a family member, wouldn't you want to make a change? So I'm not talking about politicking this. I'm just saying, when you start looking at this issue, what are some of those things? We're just up in Canada with NAT Canada, and the CEO, they have a 0.5 in Toronto, and he said when they went to that, there was a lot of grumbling, but they actually saw a significant decrease in alcohol impaired driving. And their laws up there allow them to, if not, if they have somebody that's a 0.5, they suspend them on the spot. And I was like, wow, that's so cool. And they impound the car and the whole thing. And he said, we have actually seen as part of this whole system a reduction in overall impairment because people don't want their cars impounded and all that. I know we have all kinds of issues with impoundment and, you know, making sure that the person gets their car and all that. But we wouldn't do the same thing if they were those that had guns. When we take the guns away and put them in evidence, there'd be all kinds of different changes that we would make. But for some reason, we have a tendency in our society and our culture that they've got to have their car back. And that's the weapon of really mass destruction. So I just see too many tragedies around this issue. So anything that we can do to help message this and just to be aware of, you know, why this is coming up, you know, what it would have as far as impacts to us as a state, and how would it help us or not? Do we do other things? You know, we've been pushing sobriety checkpoints for a while. We know that that's probably not going to happen. But are there other proven strategies that we could have the legislature consider and employ that help us to move the needle even more? So that's why we're just presenting this, just so you have the information to consider. So.
We have more than I know it's happening there. A lot of happenings going on in my children's schools and things. And on the blackboard, the tablet, it's very prominent the alcohol content in here, but a lot of communities have never been kind of sick packing in the room 20 years ago. And it's all over the place. I think a lot of people that drink the craft drink are a little more aware of what we can. I'm not sure a lot of these folks that go out and drink these craft beers and stuff that just drink and get food and bond and really eating and enjoying my food and doing all kinds of stuff. But it might be time to really push this. It is a good thing. It is a good thing for many people. A lot of people. We've got, you know, the guy saying he wanted to buy a case of bush for a week with him that night. You know, you don't have to do that, right? But I think when the folks coming up and they're looking for some craft type things, after they get some problems, they should buy them and come to help. But they're doing it in a different way. And it still might be something in the market there that they can do a different thing than the folks that are here all the time.
And Kate, is there a reason that we don't go for the
the sort of lift behind, we're seeing a super increase in fatalities related to drug use.
Mm-hmm.
So this, is there a reason that we don't look at something similar to what you just described with, you know, on the spot, car gone, suspended, or something that's tolerated in our state to go that way? I think about the legislature and all the things they have to do and targeting this versus targeting something that's going to get it sort of both the alcohol and the drugs. It's a big issue. It's a big issue in the country. It's, you know, coming back from the Centennial Board, we saw that that is a lot of alcohol, but also opiates. And so is there a reason we don't, we probably have one or two things we can do here, that we pick something that has a broader impact on the slide that you showed regarding overall death.
So,
you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take this one. So, I agree with you completely. I think that it's time for looking at drugs driving in new ways, and to, for example, if somebody has a little bit of alcohol in their system and they've also smoked a couple joints, they are driving like a very high PAC driver. But if they're actually stopped and arrested for that, they face criminal penalties from somebody that's in the moment. So we have a tiered system in Washington where your penalties go up if your PAC is above 1.5, you know, depending on your priors and all this stuff. But if you're below that 1.5 and you have drugs in your system, you're still being penalized at that low level in Washington. There's lots of, I think, conversations to have around drugs. The reason we're talking about 0.05 is because that is what's in front of us in the legislature. If we were to do agency request legislation, it would start right here with you guys saying, we want you to look into this. What can we do? And we would come to some conclusion, and then we would approach the governor's office. So that would be a long process. But if you guys are interested in that, we would certainly go to that session.
It seems to me that when a societal issue of opioids, it's killing our family. It's killing a certain group of people. And there's a lot of denial. And it might be that statewide, especially in more rural areas that really is listening, it might be better to put this up with some sort of study or some sort of something that we're not jumping in and attacking the alcohol and the resulting conditions for now. That might be a better thing to do. You know, if you go after the alcohol, it seems like people might be failing themselves more than used to.
Well, I think too is that there's some messaging and culture around the fact around like with marijuana and decriminalization. Is that marijuana isn't safer than alcohol. I'm a better driver. I mean, they hear all this stuff in social media. So it's almost like there's a misconception or there's a misperception that, you know, I can't drink and drive, but, you know, I can do drugs, I should be okay. Any prescription, illegal. And so there's a real misperception I think drivers have about their ability to drive. And we have all the studies, we have BAC, we have broken it down into some quantitative numbers. But when it comes to drugs, each of us are different. How we metabolize that, how it affects us, all those things are so different. And so then, you know, what our high school students hear, oh, I was smoking high today, no big deal, or better than I was, that's not a big deal, I'm a better driver. And we hear all that stuff. And so, that I think is one of those, when we saw a national study that shows public that driving the influence of alcohol is socially unacceptable, but when it comes to drugs, the responses came back that there's almost a public indifference. And so some people are like, I don't know if it's a big deal or not. So
sounds to me like we're kind of looking at a similar curve that we went through with alcohol. There was a time when it was, you know, DUI is not a real crime. I mean, everybody brings some drugs, type of thing. Everybody sort of brings some drugs to lie, and you start to fire through the combustion, you start drilling that.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I think probably by a combination of public awareness, enhanced by people, by the government, actually treating it as a crime, which is cutting the laws, by cutting enforcement and prosecution of the DUIs and what have you, societal, views on drinking and driving change. The problem is, if anybody with any toxicology background will soon be contacted with alcohol and drugs.
Yes.
It is a drug. But if we treat it, I mean, educate, I think, in terms of society, that alcohol is one thing, and drugs are something else, and you're not poisoned, they affect your body, in a very negative way. But I think for purposes of today, I think probably the focus needs to be on 105, and I think we do need to say we want more study, we want to start knocking on it as far as moving the old information. There's a lot of papers going on in the state. Safe injection zone, which is really the county, you know, the medical area. Legalization of marijuana, you know, it's actually not legal, because it's still crime under federal law, and it's really a question whether the federal government decides to enforce federal law. Why am I, besides being a half-time judge, I have a law practice, and I have a funding fee right by it. You don't want to lease your property to someone who wants to start a grow operation, you know, to be a grow operation, because the federal government has decided to enforce federal law. You may be in some trouble if you do that. My point being, and I think we need to focus on when applied today, but I think we need to work on this sort of stuff too in the administration. So this is going to become a major problem. I haven't got the latest number, but the Shell Police Department is not exactly huge. I need to be honest with you right now. Community or size of steel, so there's a lot of them that are maybe probably having and I think probably we're going to find agricultural cannabis use as well. We need to kind of shape using a vendor, but we need to focus on kind of fight. Maybe what
to do. I think the point on five is a good focus for some of the data, but kind of what you're saying, I think the public has really important, so no matter what your case is, you know, this is what it's turning into. We don't see a lot of public education. There's still what I think is in my mind that there's something like driving buzz and driving drunk. Just kind of getting that out there about what might impairment mean. So I would think any effort would be
yes. So we do public education constantly. We have twice a year we're having statewide DUI emphasis patrols. We're hesitant to focus on BAC level. So if I had my way, we'd take away all the BAC limit signs. Because an officer doesn't know what your BAC level is. You don't know what your BAC level is. What we push when we do public education campaigns is plan ahead. You know, we're not about whether or not you choose to drink personal fair water or whatever. We stay out of that discussion. We focus on three plan ahead. Please get a different ride. If you find yourself in that situation, do the right thing. If you're conducting a party, make sure you have non-alcoholic drinks. If you're going to allow people to drink, make sure you, you know, bought some extra mattresses that they can roll up and sit on your living room floor or whatever. Those are the kind of practical tips that we've been doing, especially with news release kinds of pieces. When we're doing paid media, up until this point, we've really been focusing on our target audience, which is young men between ages of 18 and 34, which is why you guys probably don't hear it very much. As we have been developing our communications, we're really looking at what we can do in terms of all of us, so doing broader reaches that would encourage traffic safety citizenship, which will include intervention strategies. You know, what do you do about this person that's at your house that wants to drive home? Or, you know, how do you plan ahead? You know. So we have a lot of hopes. We're also currently conducting research around that combination of marijuana and alcohol to try to get a sense of what that is. Is that intentional use? Is that I don't consider sober to have anything to do with my marijuana use, so I don't even think about that as part of the equation. Is it accidental? we just don't know what that really looks like. And what do you feel, is okay? Is it okay to drive after having a couple joints and some beer? We just are looking right now to kind of research that. So we're not going to ignore the drug piece by any means.
Mm-hmm. I think that would be an interesting question about the opioids. You don't know if they're going to prescription drugs, or if they're going to have a headache, or if it's actually heroin, or if it's going to
happen. I know Stacy has voiced a... Go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder if that emphasizes to you that alcohol is going to go into the brain. It's good. So if drugs positive, it's not the brain brain.
That's the big problem around a lot of these other drugs is that with alcohol, it's well researched, it's well understood, we know what those things are, generalizable. When you come to THC and others, what is that number of impairment? I mean, we have a number in our law that is just an arbitrary number. It has really no meaning. And so when it comes down to it, what do we, what should that per se limit be? Or what is, what does the research actually show? Much like alcohol, with 0.08, almost everybody is impaired. But when it comes to drugs, that is a very difficult, and that's why we've been very careful about how we message as far as impairment as compared to just being quite positive. But you could almost assume that they are impaired.
It'll be interesting. You will see at the next Results Washington that DSHS and DOH co-presenting, and just to give you a little heads up of what you'll see there, is you'll see, and it's related to deaths, what we'll be reporting on in relationship of opiates and deaths, and not traffic deaths, but just deaths. And what you see a decrease in opiate prescription, legal prescription, and you see the opposite exact increase in heroin use. So it's pretty constant. It's just the methodology, the route sort of changes in the legal prescription or is it, black market heroin stuff.
Is there any studies going on to look at the 5 nanogram and is that the right That's such a great question.
There are many, and I'm going to chalk it out to what our PSLT was for kids holding me to do about policy versus science. They're not the same. So from the initial perspective, we actually put the nanogram of completely the choke, which is going to make the outcome easier, right? You can count 5 nanograms, and just like you're saying, that's not an observation of science, though. But I didn't hear heard anyone say that it doesn't have to be something to do with poverty. So, they're right when they say that I don't have five and not embarrassed, or I don't have anything to be embarrassed. Both of those scenarios appear depending on the route, the timing, the person, the history of the use. So, for to the extent of the same, it doesn't have to be.
But there's a tremendous amount of research. And the problem that you see, and I know we're off topic a little bit, but the one thing that we see with the research is that it'll say it only doubled or maybe quadrupled your crash risk. However, a lot of those studies were only done with 3 to 6% THC. In our stores, we're seeing 29-30 with flour and then 92% in oils and other types of substances. So the federal government still against federal law, so there's lots of studies that, you know, they'd like to explore some of those higher THC levels to see what does that do as far as crash risk and how valid and all those different things. So there's still a lot of barriers there, but there are some groups that are doing quite a bit of research around this. So a lot of work. I think we're probably, what, 20 years away from where we're at with alcohol, maybe.
Traffic Safety Commission that we could approach the governor's office and when I approached the governor's office, I could say we had this discussion at the commission meeting, and all of the commissioners felt like it was a good idea, or most of them felt like it was a good idea. And I also want to know that I'm not going to support something that your own agency is saying, you know, that's such a bad idea because it impacts us this way, or, you know, so that's the core of this conversation for me.
And really, it's just as we move forward, you know, the procedural process, to go to the governor's office and see if this is something that they want to do or support.
Now, that's not to say that I would discourage you from asking your legislative liaisons to support. If you have your own processes for that, I would not impose. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Child custody, sorry, man. Thank you very much for your discussion and your thoughts, and I feel like we are on the same page, especially about where we're trying to go with our research and our communications, and we'll keep you apprised of how we move forward with that. Our child car seat law currently basically says that you should use your car seat in relationship to the manufacturer instructions. So most car seats now will allow a child to stay rear facing, so if the seat faces back. Our law says you must be there till one. Most manufacturer car seats will allow a child to be much heavier, much older in that rear facing seat. Best practice says leave your child in the car seat, the most restrictive car seat, for as long as possible. So you want to leave them rear facing for as long as possible. When they go into a forward facing car seat, you want to leave them there as long as possible. When they graduate from booster seat, you want to leave them in that booster seat. Our law says till 8. Best practice is now saying till 10 or longer, depending on the size and the weight of the child. Last session, we came up with some legislation that would move us into legislating away from the do what your car manufacturer and car seat say to do, as long as you're minimum rear facing till 1 and booster seat till 8, into something that's more prescribed. Arguments for it have been, you know, parents really don't know how much their child weighs, they know how old they are, if it says to let them out at 1, and really it's more protective to wait until they're 2, our law isn't necessarily communicating to parents what the best piece of that is. This is what NHTSA recommends. You can kind of see they have that rear facing really up until 3, but they're saying until 1 and then as long as possible after 1. The law that was introduced last year really said rear facing until 2, booster seat until 10, and in the back seat until 13. Very prescribed. The other thing that's happened since we went out with this information to you is that there was a lawsuit against the car manufacturer, car seat manufacturer, because the parents moved their child out of the rear-facing seat when they were 1, and the child was killed in a forward-facing seat. And they went out to the car manufacturer saying, you didn't protect my child correctly because I should have kept them rear-facing longer. They hired their own researchers to look at this data that the American Academy of Pediatrics and the NHTSA is basing their recommendations on. The researcher was independent, they went in, and basically, I think at this point, we're down to the point where they say, we've been saying it's 75% more, for example. And the research may indicate that it's only 55% more effective. This provided a little hiccup, and some of the people that are going after this, it'll probably be another year before we have the answer whether it's 55% more effective or 75% more effective. I don't know that that would change our thoughts about policy on this issue. But, again, this is something that Traffic Safety Commission should be supporting, should we remain neutral, should we wait for better law?
If we keep going right now, what the Washington law is going
to do? The Washington law currently says mandatory, you keep your child in a rear facing car seat until 1 for 20 years. And then it says follow your manufacturer and vehicle recommendations for protecting the child. And then it says keep them in a booster seat until they're 8. So children under 8 have to be in some form with them. Or 4'9". Yeah. But it's 8 or 4'9", and most parents know how old their child is, but they don't necessarily know how tall their child is. We have a little more... We say the seatbelt needs to fit across the hips. So if your child's legs don't go to the end of the seat, then they're staying without a car seat system, they're going to slide forward, and that belt is going to go around the middle where all their soft organs are, and you're going to lacerate organs right there and crash at that rate. It needs to hit them on the collarbone. So we know that when you put a child in a car seatbelt too soon, they wrap that seatbelt behind their back, and that doesn't afford them any protection, especially if they also slid forward. Now all of that pressure from the crash is on these soft little organs. There's recommendations and there's law, policy. So it's an interesting piece. It's being supported by Dr. Beth Abell, who's a very well-known, respected pediatrician at Harvard University and the Prevention Research Center.
Is nationally, the seatbelt laws in getting similar to what we have, or similar to these?
You know the answer?
As of last year, there was about something that had
Yeah, it's a new recommendation. Oregon changed theirs last year.
So is this legislation in Protestant here making, or is this?
This is thank you for reminding me. So this is legislation that went all the way through both houses and passed the House, made it all the way through the Senate process, and just didn't get pulled to the floor for a final vote before session ended, before first session ended. It didn't come up again in the repeat session.
Is there opposition to
it? I didn't hear anybody voice opposition to it this time. Because it went so far, I think it's likely that it would come out again, and that's why I've chosen these two, is I think that they're the most traffic safety forward legislative pieces that I think could come out again.
Did you testify last time in support or neutral? Or
I testified neutral. It's just that.
So, going back to if we pull this back up, or we just missed out because we ran out of time, whatever it was in the film. Would we be going back to the rear facing booster and back seat recommendations with 2, 8, and 13? Is that what we want? Why are we asking them to change?
So they would change our law to be more prescriptive and say this law would say rear facing itself to or as long as possible after. Booster seat, the forward facing car seat until 4, 5. No restriction, there we go. So it would actually say how long they need it to be in a forward facing, and then it would say how long they need it to be in a booster seat, and that would be until 10. So you'd move it from 8 to 10 on those. And all of the recommendations come with a set of piece that says, or leave them in that first one for as long as possible.
Forward facing, because I can remember the booster seat, which is increased from 8 to 10, and that would be 13 years for vaccine.
Which is where we are now. Yeah. I think it would provide parents with a clear idea of how long they need to leave in the best protection. And I think that's why there wasn't any really negative discussion about it, is because we're already requiring parents to put children in car seats. So they're already in the car seat, we're not asking them to purchase something new. All of these existing, rear facing, forward facing, booster seat exists. Parents are already required to do that. So there's really, it's just about how long we're leaving someone in.
So I'm assuming if you have a
two-year-old that's kind of small, and you can keep them rear facing until they're free, and then you transition to the car seat. The car seat should hold until they're high. You don't have like any medium big car seat. I mean, but this is much more restrictive.
It is much more restrictive.
Yeah, and that just does give some clarity to parents.
I think it would provide clarity.
I would say if you didn't have any, if you just ran out of time and you didn't have any real opposition, this is, to me, this is like putting in there and letting the pediatricians and the health folks
run it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we currently do a lot of information around child car seats. You know, Scott oversees our child passenger safety program, and that information is part of what we continue to do, so updating that information.
And this is our little fire district in Kalama does a child safety seat rodeo. I mean, they do a thing that people actually done is knowing that they didn't have it in the car. I mean, they get a great response from that. That's good.
So I think we're in the same position that we were with 0.05, is that we're not really going to vote on it yet, but we're pretty positive about supporting it. There is an opportunity here for maybe some agency request legislation. It comes around the idea that we exempt vehicles for hire vehicles. So if you're in a taxi cab or you're in the airport or whatever, you're not required to use a booster seat at all. Our child passenger safety experts feel strongly that this is one area where they receive a ton of questions. We have new things out there like Uber, which it's unclear if they're for hire or private. Georgia, of all places, has managed to say if you're transporting children on something with wheels, it needs to be the safest way possible. We're not going to say you don't need to be safe just because you're in a taxi cab. So not something I'm going to ask you to consider right now, but something that we may write up some information on and go through that longer process of actually requesting the legislation if you guys think it might be good.
I'm just curious. I take a train on the lot from climbing to South, but I don't like the office. I still need to be okay with the family and I'm a people in schools and I'm really anyway. When you come out of the train station, you don't really have to put your kid, I don't think, in the car seat on Amtrak. So you're walking out with a little toddler and you get into the Uber and you're all bundled in and you go. I mean, that's just kind of, as a parent, that's the decision you've made. Good. Put the thing in the car seat, cancel with that and everything else. So, I mean, there's all kinds of decisions you make, so I think the exempt thing's probably a good way to go. And at some point, the so-called nanny state kind of takes over. Parents are responsible, ultimately.
Okay?
Just for clarification,
four years of authority, which we don't have any definition around right now. Thank you for so much time. I really appreciate the good conversation.
Thank you, Shelley.
Item is the handheld cell phone cradle or state and local vehicle. Oh, hi. Yes, good morning. So at the last meeting in July, we commented on the distracted driving law and changes that were going to take place. And as part of the conversation that we had during the police committee, there was a suggestion made that that we explore the possibility of looking at our own state police, the kind of enterprise services that manages state police, exploring the possibility of asking them to possibly equip all state vehicles with hands-free devices. And so we went back and just researched the other piece of that discussion from the last meeting was developing a model policy. I'd like to thank those agencies that that submitted their model policies. And just remember, model policies, many of you bigger agencies have very robust distracted driving policies already. Model policies are really intended for smaller agencies that don't have them in place. And so we went back and developed that model policy in collaboration with the Department of Enterprise Services and the Office of Grant Management. Those model policies are in your package for review. But what I want to talk to you a little bit more about is, again, the recommendation, where are we at since the last meeting? So we've reached out to the Department of Enterprise Services to say, here's
have you thought about equipping all of these vehicles with these hands-free devices? And that's pending. I'm waiting a response from them at this point. We've already developed a model policy, and again, that's in this packet. So what's in the model policy that's a little bit different is key components include making sure that the model policy applies to all state full, part-time employees, as well as any kind of interns and volunteers. Another component of the model policy is that it does extend beyond the law in prohibiting the continued use of hands-free devices. And so rather than saying the law allows us to use hands-free devices, the model policy is no, let's not do that at all. It also references the secondary distractions that's included in the new law, as well as sets the expectations for the employees that when an employee is driving, their focus is to drive and not be responding to calls during that drive time. So any drive time is just that, drive time. So some studies have been done, and this is kind of where we went with the idea of total hands-free devices, is the vision of drivers not using cell phones is significantly reduced when they are using those hands-free devices. Even though, yeah, they're not holding the phone in their hands, they are still being distracted by the use of that hands-free device. This is a study that was done by the National Safety Council. This is also supported by AAA. So where do we go from here? Again, the decision from DES is still pending. I'm still waiting to hear a response from them. However, our recommendation is to support the model policy that sets the expectation beyond what the state law allows. And that would include withdrawing the proposal from DES to just disregard the suggestion or the recommendation to equip state vehicles and not hands-free devices. I think they set that expectation that if I have that, I'm safer, and that's not really the case. So again, it gives folks a false sense of security, and it's not eliminating that cognitive distraction. Just wanted to close the loop on the model policy. It's out there. Again, it's been shared with the Department of Enterprise Services. It's been shared with Office of Financial Management. And for the most extent, it supports what you folks have already, even though some of your agencies are much more robust than what the model policy is. So at this point, my recommendation is to withdraw that proposal from the DES. Thank you for the question. I don't know that a motion is necessarily needed, only because the way this came up at the last meeting was just a discussion, and one of the commissioners saying, have we thought about this? And so at this point, what I think I'd like to do is just close the loop and say, we considered it, and it's not something that we move forward on. Questions, comments? So the Bluetooth, the rules what we were talking about for the devices was the little either dash mount or the devices that you would mount on the vent. So those are that's the equipment that we were having conversations with CES about installing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not the Bluetooth.
It's not the Bluetooth yet.
It's just the UV one swipe.
Yeah.
But
definitely don't want to have them use the paper to find their way on.
I'm right. So I kind of have mixed feelings about at least a cradle of some sort so that you can visibly see where you're
just one is all concerned, you don't know where to go in.
Right, and I think our position is that you can turn the volume up rather than, again, the visual, it's eliminating that visual distraction. If it's on a cradle, you're going to be looking at it. So, and with the phone, you can turn the volume up and using the sound and the direction to be able to guide you. And yeah, all of this should be set even before you're automotive driving. It's that visual distraction.
I've been there 35 years and my husband and I never argued. We realized when we got the phone that I'm a voice person and I listen to the directions and follow them. And he's a dot person. He wants to see the map while he's driving. So he'll hand me his phone so I can follow the dot. I don't want to follow the dot. I want to, so I'll convert it to voice and then we start arguing. It's terrible. So I really think the voice thing and not having that distraction is just, you know, way to live.
I also believe one of our big things on school buses is we put a lot of tablets in buses now for different forms. Now we specify you cannot have it in a certain location or anything like that, but with the electronics nowadays, we're getting more and more for that, plus the GPS and everything else requires certain things. That is something that we're starting to do a lot.
I know it's hard, you know, it's, but then you think about the GPS and then it's music, and then it ties into, well, I'll just make a quick phone call, right here in front of me, you know, so it's, you know, as you tighten that down, how does that be used? I think that's part of the just making sure the drivers, especially in state vehicles, as far as risk mitigation, how do we keep that distraction down?
There is some trade-off though, in talking about not having sufficient information in this vehicle. And I guess the distraction part of it, where the alternative is that somebody has to pull off the side of the road and get back in the road or pull off safely. You know, these tests when the minimum fatal condition is there to do that, you're grabbing the control for us and the other. And most people are not dealing with the mission where they follow the track. Evolving into where we can have them bring their own surfaces in and then they can plug that into our system. So here we go. We're going to see how Scott does today.
Scott would be real well if it wasn't trying to connect to the chart. Trying to communicate to the same telephone room. We don't have one of those.
Is it an explosive one?
Yes.
You got your mountains and your rivers,
maybe.
Okay.
The lava flow.
Yes.
Yes.
I could have sold this up and walk around with it. One more try.
Okay.
But it's, you know, it's the best for them.
Scott, why don't you go ahead and get started, and we'll have a little work.
So, so we'll kind of try and pick it up. So, one of the things that I get to do at Traffic Safety Commission is the Facilitate Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council. And this is a group that was actually developed by state law, SB 5787, in 2016. And first meeting of the Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council was in March of 2016. It met through that year, really found its footing in the fall, and started to do a lot of really, really super good work about identifying what is causing what seems to be a pretty amazing upward trend in terms of pedestrian fatalities in the state of Washington. So the charge from this group is actually to develop recommendations to the legislature about how to address this problem. So to put it into perspective, between 2012 and the second quarter of this year, 2017, we've had 421 fatalities, pedestrian fatalities. That's folks walking on Washington state roadways, and some are in the neighborhood of 1,700 serious injuries during that same period of time. And 2012, beginning of 2012 to second quarter of this year, that worked out to be over 16% of our total fatalities. So when you think about Target Zero, it becomes really clear that even if we could figure out how to deal with this perplexing impaired driving situation, we would still be in arrears if we couldn't figure out how to do something about pedestrians. We're going to have to do this. So, good. Yep. So, a couple things we know are causing this to occur. First is that folks in Washington State are walking more. We know that just because there are pedestrian counts now, and there didn't used to be. So the city of Seattle has an ongoing. Yeah. Wow. Okay, there it is. Can you see it? So we've had a pretty remarkable increase in public transportation usage in the state of Washington. And one of the things that means is that, oh yeah, now you're gonna fast forward. One of the things that means is that folks are actually becoming pedestrians more often. Because as soon as they leave their car to walk to the bus or the train or whatever, they're on foot, they're pedestrians now. So we're finding that is one of the pieces that's happening. One of the challenges in this, and I'll tell you, is that there's no rate that you can calculate. We don't know exactly how many pedestrians are out there. We don't know. We know that 421 people killed is bad. But we don't know what the frequency of that is given the number of people who are actually walking, because we don't know how many people are actually walking. So some of the planning for this is kind of hard because we don't know the frequencies. We know the raw numbers, and we know the conditions under which these fatalities and serious injuries occur. So a couple of other pieces that we need to know is that 25 to 30% of Washingtonians do not use a vehicle in any way, shape, or form, or drive. They do not drive. This is primarily the elderly, children, and folks with disabilities. And so in order to really think about this issue, you have to think about if it was just a blank slate.
And, so it's an issue. Pedestrian safety is an issue in the state, and so the legislature decided that what we needed to do was to actually develop some recommendations about how to move forward, and that's what this group has been doing. And I'm just going to work through my screen here, because this is kind of silly. There is a chart that I would like you to see, because it really does kind of illustrate it, and maybe it will eventually materialize behind me here. But between that same period, 2012 to the second quarter of this year, 2017, we have seen this pretty consistent escalation, increase in fatalities. We had this one outlier year, and I'm just wondering if anyone has a pet theory. Mine was weather, but it turned out that that was an actual, one of the driest years in Washington State history. So it's not that people were inside, staying away from being wrecked. So we went from here, 75 to 50, inexplicably, and then bounced up the next year to just about the same point. So, ideas? What's that? Okay, that's fine.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, but
ridership has been increasing pretty consistently during this period of time, but no great jump right there. So we have the potential of reducing this, even if we don't know how. It could be the portions of the year that we tend to have the most fatalities and with pedestrians actually happen to correspond to the times when there's most light. That's when you have most people out there walking and that sort of thing. So, but it definitely could be that this particular year we just had X-ray vision for some reason. I don't know. This is truly, it's a statistical aberration as far as we can tell. But the big piece about this, as we went through our first year stuff, is that we found some pieces that were pretty consistent. Speed. Speed is the number one determiner about whether a pedestrian is going to survive. A collision with a vehicle at 20 miles an hour, 5 out of 10 pedestrians actually survive. You get that up to 40 miles an hour, 1 out of 10. So the single greatest thing that is determining survivability of a pedestrian vehicle crash is speed. Beyond that, pedestrian impairment. So this is, we were in this whole conversation about impairment with alcohol and other drugs earlier. Pedestrian impairment shows up in 34% of the pedestrian fatalities. And some of these, it's really, really interesting. These are folks who are actually complying with state law. They've lost their licenses, they're walking, but they're continuing to consume alcohol and other drugs, and that makes them at high risk because they're walking down the road and that sort of thing. So that's a really interesting piece. Driver distraction is involved in 32% of the fatalities. So again, what we were talking about with distracted driving, it shows up here all over the place. I was in Seattle yesterday. I wasn't even in downtown Seattle, I was in Rainier Valley. I was walking across the street, had the light. Everyone else was doing what they were supposed to be doing, except the car that decided it didn't really want to stop at the stoplight. And as I looked at them, screen in hand. And I resisted the temptation to go up and kick their fender. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that we're looking at. But probably like most people in this room, when I'm crossing the road, I am on high alert because we are not the strongest thing out there. This year, we worked on actually incorporating some process from the King County Child Death Review Board, so that we could actually look at case studies involving these fatalities and try and make some sense of what happened there. So what do we need to, what kind of information do we need in order to actually find out, you know, commonalities and ways that we might be able to actually intervene, generate the recommendation. We looked at several sets of case studies for pedestrians, impaired pedestrians and drivers, low speed fatalities. There's some indication that in some places we actually have some fatalities that are happening at these low speeds that are a little bit out of the pattern. We wanted to look at that. We also looked at left turn fatalities, because that happens a lot. Whenever you're at an intersection you're trying to cross, you know, it's a little bit of a gamble about whether that person in that left turn lane, if it's a dedicated left turn lane, actually is going to see you as you cross. First topic for 2018 is going to be road crossing fatalities. So what does it look like? What do those look like? So in each of these, what we've done is we've put out basically the situation for the individual that was involved, that was killed, as well as what was the driver doing as best we can from research reports and traffic and investigation reports, and what was the driver history for both the pedestrian and the drivers. So do they have any history in here? What's the level of impairment for both of those folks? Was there anything else going on? We also have looked at a number of other issues, and John actually came in and helped us out with one of these where we were where we were talking about legal protections for local jurisdictions and making, if they wanted to actually do safety planning and specifically call out pedestrian safety, and what are some of the implications for jurisdictions around that. Formal enforcement, automated enforcement was another thing that we took a look at. Land use policies that support pedestrian safety. And particularly the issue of, when you think about it, a road is built, and then 8 years later, that road is still there, but all of the stuff around it has changed. And probably the best example of that is Highway 99. And the last kind of original stretch of Highway 99 is kind of from Federal Way to Fife in there, and that's what that road used to look like. And for anyone from around here, if you drive out on Martin Way, that used to be Highway 99. It's no longer a narrow two-lane road with trees on both sides, no houses. There's businesses, there's stuff happening all over the place. So land use policies and the implications of folks allowing access for vehicles wherever they want to go. What we have remaining this year is, we have a meeting next week where we'll take, where we will literally take the 38 draft recommendations that we have, distill them down into a much smaller group, I predict, that we'll actually put into our year two report to the legislature. We'll have another meeting to review that draft report, submit it for Darren's approval mid-December and to the legislature by the end of December. And then next year, we'll continue to explore the different kinds of pedestrian issues, and kind of the recommendations that we did not put forward this year, we'll continue to try and refine and cook those a little bit to see if they can be put forward. And they may not be. I mean, not all ideas are good. what was it, policy is not necessarily a good idea or whatever. And not all good ideas are good policy, that's for sure. So anyway, that's kind of where we've been with Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council. I do want to say real quickly, there's another advisory council that I'm involved in that we've just gotten started with, which is the Bicycle Safety Advisory Council. And we've had our kickoff meeting in October, and it's a lot of the same process. What are the commonalities between fatalities and serious injuries? What can we do about that? And so those will be kind of running on a concurrent kind of time frame. Any questions?
Is there any relationship? I remember in driver's ed when it was in the school and everybody took it, that we did have a unit in pedestrian safety that when you were walking, you faced the traffic. When you were riding a bicycle, you were with the traffic. That, you know, I just don't believe people are taught that anymore. And, you know, it's amazing to me, in a little town that I live in, there's a lot of kids that walk to school. We provide a walking trail for new subdivisions to the school, yet people will drive their kids to school and they never really learn how to walk. We're doing a walking school bus workshop next week just to teach people how to walk. And I just, we lost something because people really want to live in town and go to all these things, yet they, and we build sidewalks or try to build sidewalks when they can. Yeah, I just find it amazing. I watch people all the time jogging down the road the wrong way. It's just about, it breaks my heart. People just don't know.
There has been a remarkable change in the number of schools, if you will, that elevate that to an education status. We do have a number of schools in the state that are participating in Safe Routes to School instruction, and they're actively engaged in that kind of instruction. Just putting a little bit of bicycle overlay on this, when I grew up, and probably for a lot of people in this room, the bicycle was my freedom. I mean, that was, I learned to ride, I rode and rode and rode and rode. And that is not the case for kids today. And so in 20 years, the fatality, in the period of 20 years, the average fatality age for bicyclists had gone from the high teens and low 20s, because that was young people riding bicycles, to folks in, the average is now 42, 43, 44. So that's the aging of that group. And really, there's no one coming in behind because, again, it's not really pushed and it's not really advanced and it's not really taught how to be safe. But Safe Routes to School is one of the things we have going that really tries to address that.
That's what I used to do that for. Yeah. Just to the point of information, the Department of Transportation is developing models for identification of pedestrian location. You can sort of have on the call and use some other factors to try to define the new products and the technical systems. So, nice looking at that. And that agreement with the University of Washington.
Yeah, and that will be a huge step forward when we get that. This is kind of what we have been involved in and where we're going to go in the next year. So, thank you.
Just quickly, I'd like to turn some time over to Mr. Steele if you wanted to mention the email that you had sent in reference to the request that came in from Dick Courtney.
What I'm doing, I usually do my role primarily in representation. So maybe it's an email, sometimes it's going to be watching the judge. I got this response back, and basically what she was talking about was one of the some of the terms she's doing locally. I don't know that much about it, but heard about it, but you know. Basically I think that conversation with kids and schools making videos and some type of competition for distracted driving. And put that out there, so you can touch that voice and you have to
the Traffic Safety Commission have some sort of ability to manage that audio?
So what I think I'd like to do is just have our program staff take a look at this, and then we can outreach to the group and see how we can be involved with it. If that would be amenable to you, then how we'd like to be.
That's what I'd like to do.
Okay. So.
I like the idea that.
Well, I'm delegating.
I like the idea that, because I think that if it came from the kids, it would be a connection to what would be meaningful to them to get away from distracted driving. So I really like that idea of having some of those videos come from within, but I wasn't sure how you can manage something like that from a cross state school. So that was my only question about it, but I like that idea.
I know that like State Farm Insurance and some of the other insurances have some pretty good grants that can go to school districts and groups that are doing that type of thing. We've had a lot of it in the past, so yeah, it is a good thing for
them. And we also sometimes.
One of the things that works really well in DSHS with things like this, pull things together statewide and give it that base, is creating, maybe the role would be to create a toolkit for schools to be able to, you know, we could get it, push it out and have a toolkit that gives those resources, that lays out grants and maybe, you know, videoing capability or, you know, networking kind of thing. It helps a lot.
Yeah, we know that we've seen a lot of success here. They have a few people listen to them more than they do with, you know, some of us in the room. But because if you're wearing a gun and a badge, you know, they like to listen to them. But the ultimately is seeing how this particular idea and then, you know, with our resources that we could bring to bear as well. I think we'll explore that, and then we can follow back up with you well with the information. So, all right. Okay, I'm going to do this really fast, because it's really only 12:12. I would just like to have Nadine, if you'd stand. This is day four for the day from Nadine. She introduced herself earlier, but we stole her from State Parks, and so we are excited to have her. And if you'd like to just kind of just do a 30-second elevator speech, you did my office, so.
I'm Nadine Swimming-Pate. I spent my career at DSHS. You and I sort of know each other. And State Parks, where I was the Performance Improvement Manager, and my area of expertise are change management, risk management, and project management. And I'm excited to be here, and I'm going to be helping the rest of the program managers with their programs and hopefully making a change.
Thank you. So as we mentioned last commission meeting, with the fourth felony law that has come into place, there's additional funding that comes in from all the DAC fees, which is going to provide additional funds for us for grants and for being able to manage the impaired driving programs, speed, and some other things. We just need the additional support. And so then the Bicycle Advisory Council and all these things that we've been tasked with, we just did not have the staffing to be able to handle and manage all those resources. So we are grateful for Nadine seeing our, I think you said stellar advertisement.
I did.
Yes. She knows when to say yes. And so we're grateful for her being a part of our team. Just to kind of give you a little heads up, the Lifesavers Conference that they have every year, it draws in about 25 to 100 people to about 3,000. It's nationwide, actually it's international, I think, for the Lifesavers Conference. It's a huge, and we have been asked, and I committed for Washington State to take this on in 2023. So that's on the agenda. It will be in spring of 2023. We are going to be meeting with the Lifesavers team in about 2 weeks in Seattle to go through, select the hotels, different venues for activities and that, because they need to have the contract in place at least 5 years in advance because of the size of conference that this is at. So I just want to put that on your radar. Another thing for April 22nd through 24th of 2018 is our State Traffic Safety Conference. We did this 2 years ago in Seattle. We are going to have this one will be at the Three Rivers Convention Center in Kennewick, trying to help address some of those things within like East Washington. We have some very top-rated speakers that have already committed to coming in. Etika has stepped out, but we've got some, you know, some key folks coming in.
What's the date to them here in April?
I think it's the 22nd. Oh, was it 24th or the 26th? I'm sorry, did I miss the date? 24th or the 26th?
Yeah.
Okay. And that will be in Kennewick. We have, I think, committed one nationally recognized researcher, David Strayer from the University of Utah, who's a neuropsychologist who has looked at cognitive distractions, especially around cell phone use and other things, and he's coming. We said, well, I'm here. So, also, it just feels like we just finished the strategic highway safety plan, as we had finished and had governor's signature in 2016. As a state, by policy, or kind of what we've decided as a policy decision is to do it every 3 years. So when we kind of, you know, begin with the end in mind, we will begin in March of 2018, going out again, bringing the data teams together, the project teams. The steering committee will be Pam Hancock and John Nisbet from the Department of Transportation. And we are planning to move forward so that we can have a strategic highway safety plan ready for signature in August of 2019. Seems like we just kind of finished that one. Additionally, the federal fiscal year 2018 grant started October 1st, and that'll run through September of 2018. But with that, we just finished getting the contracts in place for all of those, and November, remind me, Mike, is it November 17th that we're going out for the advertisements?
November 27th.
Okay. November 27th, we'll be opening up the federal fiscal year 2019 grants. Those solicitations will go out, and they'll be back due in February. We've actually are starting earlier this year, just to give people some additional time, especially through the holidays. And then we'll be having our commission meeting in April, where we need all the commissioners there so that we will have a forum so that we can then vote out all of those grants for the federal fiscal year 2019. Got a lot of work going. I know that the strategic highway safety plan is resource intensive, but when we get that and the work that we do, it's worth everything we do. It's worth every penny, and it's worth every minute that we put into that. Just to give you just a little heads up, we've talked a lot about drug driving. We've talked about a lot of the issues around alcohol. We have seen issues as far as the time that it takes to process an impaired driver. And it's about 139 minutes to process somebody just for breath, and about 239 minutes to process somebody if you're getting blood. That became warrants and trying to get the blood and getting some hospital staff and all that. There's all kinds of issues that play into that. So we have worked with and have tried to get agencies to start thinking about doing a law enforcement phlebotomy program. We did a grant through our Washington Impaired Driving Advisory Council. Those were state funds that we utilized to create a program. Lakewood Police Department has taken that on. They trained 6 officers. And I just met with the chief on Monday night. We actually went up to the city council and presented the chief with recognition before the city council and the mayor, and thank them for their leadership and the support behind that. And he's indicated that they just have an officer that was a nurse in the Army, and she is now trying to go through the process. So they'll have 7 officers in Lakewood. The Pierce County Sheriff's Department also made a proposal. They have 10 deputies in training right now at the Bay Technical College, and in spring of 18, there'll be 10 more. We've also got requests from Eastern Washington, Southwestern Washington, and so we're starting to see some of these proposals coming in. The whole idea is to help be able to reduce the amount of time that it takes for the officer to process a DUI, but also to get better evidence for their cases for impaired driving. And we've seen when oftentimes we just get alcohol, they will just process them, and we get the DAC. And there are oftentimes there are multiple other drugs that are in the system that can be leading to impairment. But blood, we start to see a much broader, you know, picture, and hopefully that will help through that process. We did the distracted driving observational survey from 16 to 17. I reviewed it. It's going to be out on our website. It's there now. And this is pre, just want to make sure we look this, this is pre 5289, the pre-distracted driving law. So we will be doing some follow-up after that is done. But I just want to make sure that you can see, it's just the observational survey to see how many drivers were operating with a cell phone in their hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're hoping to see a significant.
You guys have a question on the awareness of the new law?
This is also a great reason for you guys to
The methodology is very similar to our seatbelt observation. So we have an observer and a data collector, and they're just seeing who has the seatbelt. So we're not actually interacting with people, at least with that observation. I just wanted to share, as an agency, as a Traffic Safety Commission, we see what's happening within our state. We try to employ all kinds of best practices, evidence-based strategies, looking at the data. We have several of our folks that are on national committees and work groups and other groups that are looking at a variety of different aspects, from research to the program staff, to the traffic research board, or the transportation research board, a variety of things. And I just thank my staff for the willingness that they have, the energy, the passion, and the excitement that they bring in. So, I mean, this is a fun place to work. That's what keeps doing everybody. And so, but I just thank you as commissioners for the time and effort you have to bring in, to come in. I know we send you stuff out, being able to take the time to review that and being prepared to come in. Is we've seen here in this arena the issues around drug impaired driving. This is not just a state issue or a national issue, this is an international problem. And I will be leaving tomorrow. I've been asked to come over to Lisbon, Portugal to do two presentations on the impact of impaired driving on legalization. And Glenn Davis from Colorado, who he and I just seem to kind of be shadowing each other around, are going to be doing that. Also be on a panel from a gentleman from the Netherlands and one from Canada for our first presentation. It's the third annual International Driver Impaired Symposium, and that is going to be butted up right next to the second annual International Drug, what do they call it? I'll make sure it was correct. It's the second European Conference on Addictive Behaviors and Dependencies. And so I'll be doing one presentation at each conference. And what's interesting is that this incorporates the European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addictions, Canadian Coalition of Substance Use and Addictions, who did the invite and is sponsoring my travel, the National Institute of Drug Addiction, which is their national program, the World Health Organization, the United Nations Office for Drugs and Crime, and then there's a host of other groups from transportation groups that are a part of this. It's nice to be a part of this, to see what's happening at an international level, what's working, what's not, and being able to bring those types of things back to our group here at the Washington.
There was a
difference
from
here. It's
Canadian Coalition of Substance
Use. The conference on addictive behaviors and dependencies. That's the second conference. The first one is on the driving, but it's the symposium on drug impaired driving. So, just lastly, we've seen our fatality rates. You saw the slide here. This time, last in 2015, we were at 420. In 2016, we were at 408. In 2017, we were at 415. So we're still kind of flatlining. We're not seeing any great reductions this last 3 years. We're kind of about the same over the last three as far as our fatal rates. I'm hoping that maybe now we get some rain and we get some cooler weather that we'll start seeing some reductions. That's my hope. We've been chasing bad weather since just January, February. We had really nasty winter, lots of fatals in that time period, and I'm hoping that we can see some reductions. But I just want to let you know where we're at year to date from where we were the last 3 years. And with that, that is my report. Sorry. That is my 2 minutes.
So, okay. Do I need to motion for
We're adjourned. Thank you all.